Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. This is part four of our series, The Blue Pill or the Red Pill, Politics and Ideology.
The Matrix is definitely a political film. It's not partisan political. It's not overtly Marxist or anarchist or conservative or liberal or any of these kind of things. But it is nevertheless a political film. And that's evidenced by the very last scene of the first film. Anna, what does it say at the end of that?
I think in the last scene, which there'll be a link to this scene in the write-up below, Neo is in a phone box and you hear his voice and he is talking to the machines. And he says something along the lines of, I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. A world without rules or boundaries. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world where anything is possible.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he's going to show them a world where they're actually free from the machines.
Yeah.
And he knows that the machines are in their little machiney way. Actually, really quite terrified of this. Because it does probably mean the end of their...
hegemony.
Yeah, their power and possibly their survival.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that makes it pretty plain that it's a political film. Yeah, the machines rule the world. And they've
enslaved the human race.
They've enslaved the human race. And they've done it by pulling the world over the eyes of the population, as Morpheus says right at the outset in the film, you know, early on in the film. And, of course, Neo, having taken the red pill, is able to see beyond that veil. That world is lifted from his eyes. The world which hides you from the truth. In other words, the Matrix. So, the film identifies this political truism that the powerful in any society are much better off ruling by consent than having to use force all the time. Now, any state, you know, which operates on behalf of the powerful in society does have a reserve of violence. You know, the ultimate backstop of state power is violence. When push comes to shove, the troops will go on the street at the order of their masters, and they will open fire. And this has happened in this country. I mean, the great Winston Churchill, when he was the Home Secretary, ordered British troops to open fire on striking miners in South Wales early on in the 20th century. I mean, sometimes people say, well, it can't happen here, because we know it happens all around the world. But violence wielded by the state is counterproductive. For a start, it engenders more determined resistance to the state power if violence is used, and it also, of course, wastes productive forces. I mean, if you're going to kill people or make a situation on the streets that people won't go to work, wealth creation stops, and those that profit from that wealth creation, of course, are no longer going to profit from it. I do. I mean, the whole point of the system is wealth creation for the benefit of the powerful. So violence is a last resort. But nevertheless, if a society is going to hang together, and if people are going to be dutiful in work, in other words, in wealth creation, wealth production, you do need people to be thinking along the same lines in many instances. You do need a system of ideas and beliefs that's kind of held in general in order to ensure social cohesion and in order to preserve existing power relations. And that really is the gist of that last scene in the first film of The Matrix. Now, political theorists, particularly Marxist political theorists, call that system of beliefs and ideas, they call it ideology. I mean, ideology is a word with a few uses, you know, but this is the way we're going to use the term here. And I mean, an ideology might be consciously or unconsciously held, even though it seems to me that the picture that's painted in The Matrix is that the ideology is mostly unconsciously held. You know, the Matrix is the world pulled over your eyes to prevent you from seeing the truth. You know, it's kind of unconsciously held. The people who are in The Matrix don't know they're in The Matrix either. You get a few rebels who get an inkling and pursue that inkling to see if they can get a broader picture and get more information and so forth. But for the most part, it's unconsciously held. So, it is a political film, and just as much as the red pill blue pill story can be thought to describe Platonism and metaphysics and the notion that there's a deeper reality and so forth, we can just as easily say it relates to the workings of ideology. And you know, we are given a very clear pointer in that final scene of the film, which Anna just recounted, that the authors want you to sort of at least read the film that way, even if you're reading it that way amongst other ways. Now, it seems to me that there's a question that underpins this way of looking at The Matrix. And I think it's a big question. I think the popularity of The Matrix, you know, its cult film status, attests to the importance of the question. And that question, phrased in a slightly polemical way, is this: why do slaves acquiesce in their slavery? Well, there is, as we've said, you know, any society holds itself together with the ultimate threat of violence, and there is the threat of violence. I mean, if you don't toe the line in society, even a relatively liberal society like ours, you'll be discouraged by, well, being fined, which is violent, or being sent to prison, which is definitely violent. You know, it involves the violence of incarceration, and maybe eventually even being killed. If you resist arrest with weapons, the police or the army will turn up with bigger weapons, and the state has always got bigger and better weapons than everybody else. I mean, all that crap in America about the right to bear arms, as if push come to shove, it would make any difference that there are a few militias have got some assault rifles and so forth. The American state's got armoured vehicles, rockets, nukes, submarines. You know, they'll always
just send in the drones, really.
Yeah, just send in the drones. I mean, the state will always win if it comes to that. But as I said, you know, that is the backstop. That's the ultimate threat. But the real mechanism keeping the society going is by gaining consent, or by producing consent. And it's not done by pleading particularly, you know, you must believe this, It's done in a much more hostile way than that. Consent is manufactured. I think that's Noam Chomsky's phrase, you know, the manufacture of consent. It's not consent isn't won, it's manufactured. And of course, which is precisely what we've got in the Matrix, is that the consent is manufactured just by the electrical stimulation of the brain.
Yeah.
and the incarceration of the physical body. Bodies of the citizens in vats of amniotic fluid. I mean, this is obviously a poetic way of really, really underscoring the fact that the consent of the slaves, whether they're wage slaves or formal legal slaves, is manufactured and not gained or won by rational argument or anything like that. Manufactured. Now, this was a big question for Marxism from the time of its origination in the middle of the 19th century, in the writings of Marx and Engels, and right the way through the 20th century, and with all kinds of questions that were raised by the fate and the nature of the Soviet Union, which claimed to be a state founded on Marxism-Leninism. So there's been a whole lot of interest in this question. And there is a lacuna in Marxism, in that it doesn't have much of an answer to the question of why slaves acquiesce to their slavery. The answer that it has got is, it says, well, it's the workings of ideology. You know, an ideology works by producing false consciousness. In other words, the working class don't rise up and throw off their masters and throw off the iniquitous exploitation of their labour, because they believe that their slavery is a part of the natural order, you know, and that's what they have, a false consciousness about their real situation. And the job of Marxism is to tell them what their real situation is, that they are exploited, that they are hoodwinked and so forth. And again, the analogy with the Matrix is exact analogy to that. But Marx wasn't really able to say much, or didn't get round to saying very much about how will that work? How does the false consciousness get there? And actually, isn't there a problem around the idea of attributing false consciousness to people? You know, if people can fall under false consciousness, how do you know that you yourself are not under false consciousness, and that your criticism of the system isn't itself locked into the Matrix, if I can put it like that? Is there any way out of the Matrix? Is there anything in philosophy or thought or analysis that enables us somehow to hover, to get enough distance from the Matrix to see it, and then realise that everybody's in a state of false consciousness? Or couldn't that reading of the situation itself be false consciousness? You know, there are certain kind of problems, logical problems with the whole notion. But quite apart from that, as I say, Mark didn't say very much. There's one passage in Capital Volume 1, which is known as the fetishisation passage, in which Marx seems to recognise the notion of the unconscious, of how the human mind can fetishise an object. And he actually talks about how money becomes a fetishised commodity. You know, it can be endowed psychologically with more value than it actually has, become like a fetish, and there's an irrational attachment to it. And in that, you kind of get the beginnings of an idea of how false consciousness might come about, or if you like, how people get plugged into the Matrix, or what tendencies are exploited for people to get plugged into the Matrix. And that tendency to be exploited really boils down to the fact that we have an unconscious mind, as well as a conscious mind. And as I say, there's a hint in Marx. Engels had got some stuff to say about this, which is interesting, in a book called The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State, in which Engels lights upon the importance of child rearing and education and what young children are exposed to as they develop into adults, and how those processes produce a false consciousness or a captivity by ideology. And of course this is a clue that was taken up in later developments. In the 20th century there was an immense amount of work within a Marxist framework, theoretical work, and a lot of it was directed to this problem of ideology, this problem of why people consent. And the most interesting, I think, takes up that hint of Marx's in the fetishisation passage, and that hint of Engels in his book on the family, and attempted to combine Freudianism, psychoanalysis, with Marxism, because psychoanalysis has got an account of how children grow up into model citizens, what the psychological drama is, and particularly what the psychological drama is in the context of the family, particularly the bourgeois family as it happens. Because Freud already had an account of this and had made quite a lot of observations on this, and had then theoretically elaborated the insight. And so it's kind of inevitable, I suppose, that there was going to be this attempt at a kind of a fusion to make good the lacuna in Marxism, and maybe from that work out some better paradigms for education, child rearing, and social organisation, particularly around reproduction, yeah. Reproduction of the species, or as Marx would have it, reproduction of labour power. Perhaps in the working class families, reproduction of labour power. In this way of looking at it, you see the working class family as a machine to produce workers.
Yeah.
And that's what its job is, and it has to give them the right frame of mind, the right values that are going to make them work, you know. And then there's a whole apparatus, not only the educational system, but the narratives that people are exposed to both help to inculcate the right ideology for the system into children, but also to preserve it and maintain it in adults. And you count amongst that the media, the press, the TV, the narratives exposed to in films and television series, advertising, particularly interesting. I mean, in the case of advertising, this brings to the fore the fact that not only do the Marxists and the revolutionaries see the way in which the shared ideology of a community is produced and maintained, and what actual work it does in preserving the existing power structures, in other words, capitalism. But the capitalists themselves, those that profit from it, also see it, you know, and do quite consciously use it. And this is nowhere more evident than in the advertising industry. And people very often draw this point out, you know, that Bernays is the father of modern advertising, was Freud's nephew or something. Anyway, they were related, you know, and he was clued up about the unconscious. You know, if you understand psychoanalysis, you can see what the advertisers are up to.
Oh yeah.
You know, they're talking. Yeah. They're talking to they're talking to your unconscious, you know, to in order to pressure it, to form it, to mould it, so that you will desire their product.
Yeah.
You know.
Keep the system
ticking over. Yeah. So the Matrix, let's call it the Matrix. I love to call it the Matrix. It is. It's the Matrix. The Matrix is obviously known about by the people that are responsible for it and who profit from it.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. But at the same time,
they created it, didn't they?
They created it anyway.
They know all about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though in the real world, I think it has a more organic character, you know, because I think that the wealthy and the powerful can actually believe their own ideology,
yeah.
That this is the natural order, you know, they can persuade themselves. It's actually a kind of a way of not having too much remorse of conscience, you know, is to say, oh, this is the natural order. And of course, that is the biggest ideological trope, is to put everything down to nature. This is how it is. It can be no different.
Yeah.
And how often do we hear that? It can be, no, this is going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we'll go along with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so. Of course, Neo is turning around in that last scene and saying to the powers, I know you're listening, and I'm going to make sure that everybody finds out what really is happening. I don't know the future exactly, but I'm going to expose this. You know, and that is what makes it a political film.
Something he does say at the end as well, just after he said all of that, he said, I think he ends with the sentence, what happens next is up to you.
Yeah.
So he is giving them an opportunity for peace.
Yeah, fool.
Yeah. Well, he's saying, okay, well, it's up to you. War maybe. Or peace? Well, which is it going to be?
Maybe he's being a bit naive.
Maybe. But, you know.
So, yeah.
That's what I'd do if I was him.
Yeah.
You know, I'd at least give them the chance.
Yeah. Anyway, Freudian Marxism, or Marxian Freudianism, whatever you want to say, you can see how there's a logic to it. You know, it's an attempt to see how ideology is implanted in people, and particularly through what happens in childhood. And there's some kind of interesting work being done along those lines. I mean, I think the main writers are Wilhelm Reich, who was a bit of a nutter and somewhat of a crank. He was a psychoanalyst. He'd been a student of Freud's. He thinks that Freud kind of took a wrong turn when he became less interested in the body and more interested in the narrative, in the word, in the story, when psychoanalysis became the talking cure. And but Reich continued with body work, you know, because he saw that the unconscious and repressed material was lodged in the body, and not just in the narratives to which the subject of ideology subscribes. And again, Reich saw himself returning to Freud with his emphasis on sexuality. And he actually thought, you know, that the means of keeping people down was through the control of sexuality, through the control of basic energy.
Yeah.
You know, so he had.
And in the Matrix, we see a big difference between the Matrix and the way that they portrayed the Matrix in this almost like it's got like a kind of a stilted 50s look.
Yeah.
And the colours are very muted, but when you get down to Zion and they're having that big party, the colours are all warm and vibrant and alive.
What that is, it's a polymorphous, perverse orgy, you know, of it's a carnivalesque in which capitalist sexual morality does not prevail, you know. And Reich was very much into that. I mean, he got him into trouble, and I mean, he died in prison. It's a guy who had his books burned by both the Nazis and by the Americans, which I think shows how dangerously onto something he was. But I say he was in some ways a bit of a crackpot. I mean, I think he spent the last part of his life signalling to aliens and stuff like this, you know. Maybe the stress got to him. And he was certainly he was put out by the Nazis because he was offering sex therapy to the working class, you know. And they didn't like it, and he had to go. But yeah, his work, particularly the invasion of compulsory sex morality, which uses some anthropological sources to see how the social formation of capitalism, with its dependence on sexual repression, with its dependence on the manipulation of the unconscious, how it came about as societies changed from polymorphous, perverse, possibly matrilineal societies into patriarchal societies in which women were treated as property, you know, and bargained for political reasons and married off for political reasons and so forth. And now that required monogamy for a start, you know, because then you've got, it becomes necessary for men to know who their children are if the property and the power is going to be handed down the generations along genetic lines, which of course became a fetish. So there's this whole story, and it is a bit of a just so story, and Freud himself told some just so stories like that in Moses and Monotheism and Totem and Taboo. That was kind of what he's called Freud's metapsychology. There's a whole lot of work along that. But Reich also wrote, yeah, the function of the orgasm. Yeah. And it's good stuff, if a little crazy, but as I say, the fact that everybody hated him makes me think he might have been onto something. and he fell foul of the authorities in various places. In the 1960s, the Frankfurt School, particularly Herbert Marcuse and Eric Fromm, who I believe had also been attached to the Frankfurt School, did similar work. And Marcuse's book, One Dimensional Man, which came out in the 1960s, was a key text for a student rebellion, of course, which in that part of the 1960s, all around the world, there was considerable revolutionary upheaval, you know, led by students, you know, the famous stuff in Paris, but of course all over America, in line with the attempts to stop the Vietnam War, this terrible, unjust imperialist war. And Marcuse was a bit of a hero, and he also wrote Eros and Civilization, and these are Marxist Freudian inspired, you know, they're their own things. He was his own thinker, but he saw this way of making good the lacuna in Marxism around the actual nature of people's acquiescence to the unjust and exploitative capitalist system.
Hey up, I know we're here. Helicopter, yeah. Going past.
Yeah, that's a military helicopter as well. It's not like the police one. That's a helicopter gunship, that is, you know.
I know we're doing this recording today.
Of course they do.
Just making sure that, that we know they're watching.
Yeah. This is going straight to HQ. They're straight out of the little recorder, straight to HQ. Anyway, not that we believe in conspiracy theories or anything like that. And we're definitely not paranoid. Anyway, it's gone now. Eric Fromm was a case in point as well. I mean, he was kind of quite beloved of the hippies. He was a Freudian Marxist. But what he tended to do is not so much attempt to synthesis, but to put Marxism and Freudian and psychoanalysis side by side. And from himself, he wasn't a psychoanalyst, and a fairly committed, open-minded Marxist. You know, he took Marx seriously, which I do think you have to do, really, to be honest. You know. And he was kind of beloved of the hippies, and he did sort of move away from psychoanalysis a little bit, and he wrote books about Rumi and about love. And a wonderful book called To Have or To Be, which more or less gave like hippieism a sort of a respectable theoretical framework. And it is, it's a book that is alert to the unconscious and to the way in which society and the powers that be attempt to structure the unconscious of the population at large in order to control society and therefore to exploit it to their own advantage. It's an excellent thing, but he also wrote about, as did Wilhelm Reich actually, about fascism. Now, there's a book called Fear of Freedom, and that's largely given over to character analysis of some of the key Nazis. And this is taken up and expanded in a book called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, which is sort of quite psychoanalytical. And again, it looks at some of the key Nazis. And I mean, Fromm was an active writer during the period of World War II and just after. Reich, of course, wrote about the mass psychology of fascism, which he put down to sexual repression, ultimately, you know. So anyway, the Matrix, you know, points to all this. Obviously, if you want more detail, you have to go away and study, and it's a huge field. And I've kind of harboured a desire to write a survey, you know, of Freudian Marxism. Never got round to it, and I doubt I will ever get round to it, but it would be a nice project for somebody. Oh, well, I suppose I should mention in this vein, because we're doing a name dropping now, it's just a big study guide and name dropping. Slavoj Žižek, you know, who is obviously currently very active. And again, he's attempted this making good the lacuna in Marxism around ideology, and he finds ideology everywhere, you know, particularly in films and so forth. And he does point out that, you know, Hollywood is an ideological state apparatus, using Althusser's terminology there. And Žižek points out that when, shortly after 9/11, all the big moguls from Hollywood had a big meet up at the White House with the president and the president's cabinet, you know, saying, well, how can we use the entertainment industry to now structure the public understanding of these events?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. In fact, like, these were events that had been prefigured in disaster movies. It's almost like the terrorists, or whoever decided to blow up the Twin Towers, got their inspiration from disaster movies, you know. And the disaster movies might well have been some kind of ideological preparation for terrorist reprisals for what America was doing in the Middle East. You know, so anyway, he's got a lot to say about that. I mean, he did actually write a little pamphlet about the 9/11 called The Desert of the Real, which is, of course, a direct quote from The Matrix. Well, in fact, like The Matrix, that phrase, The Desert of the Real, is a quote that Morpheus uses, which is from somewhere else. There is some kind of polemical book entitled that, I believe. I forget by whom. Anyway, like, you know, it's... everything refers to everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, in the modern world, where the signs and the symbols and the narratives and the stories are bumping around at a vastly accelerated rate through the internet and modern communications, and but there it is. Anyway, Žižek's thing is rather than drawing on Freud directly, he mostly draws on Lacan, who was the French Freud. People call him the French Freud. So he's obviously a Freudian psychoanalyst and theoretician who combined psychoanalysis with structuralism, a particularly kind of French intellectual movement. And instead of using Marx, which he does use Marx, Žižek, and he's, yeah, very well acquainted with Marx, but he kind of pushes it further back to Marx's original inspiration in Hegel, So you've got like Hegelian Lacanianism. Zizek obviously pins his hopes on being able to make good this lacuna in the revolutionary understanding of ideology and the consent of the masses to their enslavement. He feels he can get a better purchase on it by pushing Freudian Marxism apart into a kind of Hegelian Lacanianism. I mean, and the details and the ins and outs of his reasoning are something that I kind of wonder about, but haven't really solved that one yet, why he decided to go that way with it. So I suppose this podcast has turned into like a bit of a reading list. But the point is, get back to the main point, is that the film, The Matrix, does ask this question, you know, why don't we rise up? You know, and it's probably because we believe that this is the natural order of things in some way. See, ideology, what it does, it mystifies. Yeah, its job is to mystify. Yeah. And to conceal exactly what the Matrix does on Morpheus's take. You know, the Matrix is that which is pulled over your mind to keep you from seeing the truth. And I think it's correct that we don't have much chance of seeing through the situation without employing a notion of the unconscious. And without trying to get to some kind of understanding of child rearing and how that works and what it does. And an understanding of education and an understanding of the circulation of signs and symbols and meanings and narratives within the body politic through the various media that we use to communicate. I think all of those things have to be examined thoroughly if we're going to get a sense of yes, we are in the Matrix, and secondly, how we can get out of the Matrix. None of that's possible without that further study. And again, I think the film recognises that. And because immediately you become interested in the unconscious, you become interested in your own unconscious. You know? And it's these questions, now they are political questions, and that can be subverted by navel gazing, which nevertheless point us towards the necessity of our own self-exploration as well. So even though we don't want to fall foul to the excesses of navel-gazing, which turn us away from political reality, at the same time we can't not at least attempt to know ourselves.
Okay, I hope everybody could follow that. Went through some noisy patches. There was a terrible high wind yesterday, so it's actually been a bit of a struggle getting down the path today because there's lots of fallen branches and things to climb over.
Yeah.
But we've made it.
Yeah.
So I hope that was useful for you all, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks for listening.